content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 18, 2025, the day in which I am reading this. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a white narrower inner border. Time is in large block print, capitalized, and it is in varying shades of off-white to gray because it is superimposed upon a background that has gradations from a vanilla yellow or beige into a darker muted gray tone. A portrait is superimposed in the front of that background. It's of a man with graying hair, wearing glasses, looking askance of the camera, neither smiling nor frowning, but with something of a straight line lip maneuver, wearing a dark suit coat, white shirt, and dark tie. The lapel pin is that of a tiny, well, not so tiny, American flag. The survivor, Mike Johnson. How Mike Johnson deals in Trump's Washington. And beginning now with the brief, The Epstein Shadow, by Philip Elliott. Epstein is spelled E-P-S-T-E-I-N. Donald Trump's embrace of conspiracy theories has backfired. Again, this is by Philip Elliott. Donald Trump has openly flirted with nearly every major conspiracy theory of the past half century and championed one of the most reckless through his insistence without evidence that the 2020 election was stolen. But what has dominated the summer of 2025 is an intrigue he spent much of the previous year promising to crack if he returned to office, the truth about how registered sex offender and billionaire Jeffrey Epstein lived and died. There's a photo here, by the way, of Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago in 1997. They're both grinning. Like so much else that grew into a headache for Trump, this started with pursuit of a quick headline without thinking how it might end. Now the Epstein saga has become a snowball racing down Mount MAGA that the president has lost the capacity to stop. To recap, Epstein was at the center of a network of super-rich and privileged people, rumored to exploit young women and girls as part of a sex trafficking scheme that was said to include a whole host of bold-faced names. Trump, even though he counted Epstein as a friend for over a decade, nonetheless fed suspicion about the former Mar-a-Lago regular at campaign rallies and in online posts. In 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty in Florida on two state felony charges, paid restitution to three dozen victims, and registered as a sex offender. A decade later, Epstein pleaded not guilty in New York to multiple charges, including sex trafficking. He died in 2019 in a Manhattan jail cell. Officials ruled it a suicide, yet many Trump fans were convinced he was murdered to protect the hyper-connected insiders who might have been implicated should Epstein turn on his former pals. For years, Trump hinted there was an Epstein client list. And weeks into his second term, Attorney General Pam Bondi announced it was on her desk. And MAGA influencers were handed binders of documents that they waved for cameras. It turned out those binders carried documents that were already mostly out there. Then in early July, Bondi and Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, director and deputy director at the FBI, released a statement saying no further disclosures about Epstein were in the offing and that there was no incriminating client list. The memo went off like a bomb in the president's political base. Former Trump strategist Stephen Bannon warned as many as 10% of Trump supporters may defect over feeling shortchanged, perhaps costing House Republicans a dozen seats next November. Trump's efforts to beat back the storm took several forms. He scolded his base on social media, calling the issue Bull SH space T, and declaring he no longer wanted the support of those who remain skeptical. He blamed Democrats and called for an investigation of Barack Obama. He also instructed his Justice Department to request the release of usually secret grand jury proceedings on the case. Then, July 17, the Wall Street Journal reported Trump had sketched a naked woman on a birthday greeting to Epstein and written the two have certain things in common and may every day be another wonderful secret. Trump sued the Journal and his base rallied. But the spiral continued. Within a week, it emerged. Bondi had alerted Trump back in May that his name had come up several times in the investigation. Even before that revelation, House Speaker Mike Johnson had taken the extraordinary step of announcing lawmakers would go home on summer recess several days early, explicitly to avoid a floor vote on an Epstein investigation. But there was still time for the House Federal Law Enforcement Subcommittee to subpoena the Justice Department files on Epstein. The July 23 vote also subpoenaed a deposition from Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's longtime confidant, who is serving a 20-year sentence for sex trafficking. Trump raised eyebrows by noting on July 28 that I am allowed to give her a pardon. Three of the panel's five Republicans voted with Democrats. But then, before shuttering the House on Trump's behalf, Johnson, mindful his majority is razor thin and in danger, told right-wing podcaster Benny Johnson that he too favors transparency. It is a very delicate subject, but we should put everything out there and let the people decide it, the speaker said. Those eyeing a 2028 campaign also took the bait. This is why people don't trust government, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley posted on X. Redact victims' names, but release the rest. Trump understands both the power of the rumble and the unpredictable nature of sparked kindling. Over a decade ago, he fed the wrong and racist trope that Obama was not born in the United States and was thus an illegitimate president. He promised to release the files linked to John F. Kennedy's assassination and suggested someone needed to audit Fort Knox for missing gold. On Epstein, he promised the goods, and whether the goods do not exist or they are potentially embarrassing to him or his buddies, his conspiracy-addled allies have been triggered in a way not seen in his first term. But that's the thing about conspiracy theories. Once they take hold, there's no turning back. The bulletin, Japan's matcha, M-A-T-C-H-A, suppliers cannot keep up with Our Demand by Rebecca Schneid. The powdered Japanese green tea, known as matcha or maybe matcha, has become such a cultural phenomena in the West that its popularity has resulted in a global supply problem. Though Western consumers have thirsted for the drink and its perceived health benefits in recent years, the trend was boosted by social media, particularly TikTok. Meanwhile, Japan experienced a rise in tourism since the COVID-19 pandemic, welcoming a record-breaking 36.9 million international visitors last year, and also boosting demand for matcha. In October, two well-known matcha companies, Ippodo and Marukyu Koyaman, limited or stopped selling certain kinds of matcha, citing short supplies. July 18, Ippodo said that in the face of unprecedented demand, supply constraints are likely to continue. Matcha originates from China, but has become closely associated and rooted in Japanese culture, making up 6% of the country's tea production, according to the Global Japanese Tea Association, GJTA. It is a type of green tea made from tencha, a shaded green leaf tea. The processing, form, and taste differ significantly from other green teas. The crop is heavily dependent on weather patterns. Producers have attempted to make up for shortages with the spring harvest, but hot and dry conditions in the Kyoto region, where much of Japan's tencha grows, has impacted yields, farmers and importers say. In May, Zach Mangan, founder of Kettle Tea, a Brooklyn-based company that imports Japanese teas, called this year's harvest a high-quality but lower-yielding harvest in a blog post. Soaring demand for matcha boosted prices. According to the GJTA, the average price for tencha in late April reached 8,235 yen, around $55 per kilogram, 1.7 times as high as last year's average. Producers anticipate that trend will continue. The matcha market is expected to hit about $5 billion by 2028, an unexpected growth of more than 10% since 2023, according to Forbes. Further, Japan's agriculture ministry has reported that the 2024 tencha output was over 2.5 times as high as in 2014. Here's a photo, almost half a page. It's in color, and I will read the caption after I attempt to describe it. It looks like the inside of a culvert to me. It's concrete with a rounded top and a flat surface on the bottom. It's painted white, or was attempted to have been painted white at some point in time. There's a man seated on what looks like a mat, perhaps a bamboo mat, on that level ground floor. He's dressed in orange-looking coveralls. He has dark or perhaps salt-and-pepper-colored hair, and he wears glasses. Next to him is a small dog. I would call it a terrier, but I'm not sure. It appears to be short-haired, white with brown markings. And on a ledge in what I'm calling a culvert, and I don't know what it is, we'll find out in a few seconds, there's a large bottle of water. Taking Shelter is the title of the photograph. A Buddhist monk waits out an alert in a bomb shelter in Surin, Thailand, July 25. Thailand and neighboring Cambodia went to war for several days over a disputed border, leaving at least 38 people dead and displacing thousands. A tenuous ceasefire went into effect July 28 after President Trump threatened to suspend trade talks. The brief news, I've turned the page to good question. Why can't seniors afford long-term care? By Alana Samuels. Aisha Adkin's mother, Rosetta, was adamant she wanted to age at home. So when Rosetta's dementia started worsening at age 59, Aisha started looking around for options. She quickly found round-the-clock, at-home care was extremely costly, and her mother did not qualify for government assistance because of her father's income. Stuck in the middle, Aisha, who was 29 at the time, ended up quitting her job to take care of her mother herself until Rosetta qualified for Medicaid through a complicated process called spousal impoverishment protection, which allowed her father to keep some assets. It was really a struggle, says Adkins. She cared for her mother for a decade until Rosetta's death in 2023. As the U.S. population ages, more families are facing the same challenges. Long-term care, which is assistance with the activities of daily living, either in a person's home or in a facility, is expensive. Most people pay for it, either out of savings or by spending down those savings until they qualify for Medicaid, the government payer of last resort, which is for low-income seniors or people who have spent down their savings. Medicare does not cover senior housing or long-term care. But there's a large group of people who are stuck in between. They're too rich to qualify for Medicaid, but they do not have enough money to pay for the in-home, all-hours care they need. It then falls to family members to make up the difference. Around two-thirds of caregiving hours for older adults in the U.S. are provided by informal and unpaid caregivers. On one end of the spectrum are the expensive communities for seniors with deep pockets who want to start out in apartments and continue on to assisted living or more extensive care. This type of facility has attracted money from investors in recent years. On the other end, there are nursing home spots available for people who qualify for Medicaid. But there are not a lot of middle-income options on the market, so inevitably people rely on family care and out-of-pocket home care until they end up qualifying for Medicaid, says David Grabowski, a professor of health care policy at Harvard Medical School and one of the authors of a 2019 study about middle-income seniors. His research predicts that as the U.S. ages, many seniors will have insufficient resources for housing and health care needs. People like Rosetta Adkins are often referred to as the forgotten middle, because they're stuck with so few options when it is time to look for care. One 2021 study estimated a nursing home in the U.S. on average costs $100,740 per year for a semi-private room, and that home care for 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, costs $42,120 a year. The costs have only gone up. There may be even more people in this situation going forward after the giant cuts to Medicaid and the Trump economic plan recently approved by Congress go into effect. Home and community-based care for low-income seniors is considered an optional program in Medicaid, so states can cut it when their budgets are thin. The uncertainty in the U.S. stands in contrast to many other countries. The Netherlands, for instance, includes long-term care in its universal health care system and requires that taxpayers contribute a chunk of their income toward insurance premiums. Japan has had a mandatory long-term care insurance system since 2000. It requires people 40 and over to contribute. Most experts agree the U.S. needs some sort of plan to help more seniors pay for long-term care, especially as baby boomers age. Otherwise, many people will spend down their savings till they qualify for Medicaid, which is going to get very expensive for the U.S. government. We are going to be swamped by just the pure number of individuals in the system who need long-term care going forward, says Grabowski. It's a discussion we really need to have. It is something Aisha Adkins knows at her core. Although her mother passed away 2 years ago, Adkins is gearing up for another struggle. Her father was recently diagnosed with a type of dementia too. He spent almost all his savings paying for Rosetta's care. Now Aisha is looking into options for him. She knows from experience that they will be limited. Here are the brief milestones, two pages of them. I'll start with the longer articles first, all three of which are under the category of died. Malcolm Jamal Warner, beloved sitcom actor, by Michael Denzel Smith. Smith is a writer. His most recent book is Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream. The loss of Malcolm Jamal Warner, who died July 20 at 54 in a drowning accident while vacationing with his family in Costa Rica, has been widely felt. The cultural impact of The Cosby Show, on which he played the family's only son, Theo Huxtable, cannot be overstated. And Warner was an integral part of it. The show possibly does not even work without him. For everything it sought to do in presenting a black family that was not mired in trauma, its heart could be found in Warner's portrayal of Theo, trying his best to navigate the lofty expectations that come with such freedom, while also wanting simply to be a teenager. For 8 seasons in the 1980s and early 90s, Theo was presented as a chronic underachiever, more interested in the trappings of boyhood than achievement. His college graduation in the series finale is a full circle moment, a testament to how possessed of his confidence he was, how he never let the harshness of his father's expectations dim his good nature. Warner, through Theo, became the relatable, stylish older brother a teenager of the 80s could hope to be or befriend. While the long shadow of Bill Cosby has loomed darker in recent years, Warner forged a career that he did not rely on audiences, knowing he was once on one of the most popular sitcoms. He scored comedic and dramatic roles from the late 90s sitcom Malcolm and Eddie to 2016's The People v. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. He won a Grammy and was nominated for a second. He may not have become bigger than The Cosby Show, but he became his own person, his own artist, something beyond the relationship his audience forged with him. One of the most memorable of his post-Cosby turns is an episode of the sitcom Community from 2011, where he plays Andre, the previously unseen ex-husband of Shirley Bennett, Yvette Nicole Brown. In a quiet moment, another character remarks, "Nice sweater," and Andre replies, "Thanks, my dad gave it to me." The sweater in question bears a striking resemblance to the kind Bill Cosby became famous for wearing, but Malcolm Jamal Warner made it all his own. The photo accompanying this article is of Malcolm Jamal Warner as a teenager. He's grinning at that camera. A round face, brown eyes, smooth and finely cut black hair, and he just looks swell. Another died, Hulk Hogan, wrestling superstar, by Chaz de Guzman. And here we have Hulk pictured in his wrestling getup. It's all yellow on this particular photo. It's a tank tank top shirt and kind of a kerchief tied around what looks like to be bleached blonde hair. He's flexing his muscles, wearing a wristwatch on his left wrist, and it looks like he's got some big gold necklace deal hanging down on his chest, and I can't determine what it is. It blends in with that yellow tank top, and he's kind of smirking at the camera like Hogan is in charge. And indeed, it says Hogan across the front of his bandana. Terry Jane, G-E-N-E, Bollea, B-O-L-L-E-A, who was better known by his ring name, Hulk Hogan, died July 24 after suffering cardiac arrest. He was 71. Bollea began wrestling in the late 1970s and found success on the U.S. and international stage. Known for his dramatic entrances to the tune of Rick Derringer's Real American, his bulging biceps that he called 24-inch pythons, his catchphrases including, "What you gonna do, brother?" and his legendary rivalries such as with Andre the Giant, Bollea captivated audiences and was credited as a central figure in WWE's rise. During the Hulkamania of the 1980s and 90s, Bollea's fame extended beyond wrestling. As an actor, product sponsor, and one of the most requested personalities for Make-A-Wish Foundation. In the 2010s, his career and personal life were rocked by sex tape scandals, including one in which he used racist language. Later in life, Bollea became known for his political activism. During the 2024 Republican National Convention, Bollea gave a rousing speech in support of Donald Trump, who said in a tribute after Bollea's passing that Bollea was MAGA all the way. Bollea will be missed but never forgotten, his family said in a statement. He is survived by his wife, Sky Daly, ex-wives Linda Hogan and Jennifer McDaniel, and children, Brooke and Nick. And finally, another article with the caption, "Died." Ozzy Osbourne, O-Z-Z-Y. O-S-B-O-U-R-N-E, heavy metal pioneer. This photograph is in black and white, and it is Ozzy Osbourne with his long, dark hair flowing over his shoulders, his dark glasses, and his mouth wide open, while his two hands surround, actually, his face. Chantel Lee writes this. Ozzy Osbourne, the heavy metal star who fronted the British rock band Black Sabbath, died July 22 at the age of 76, his family said in a statement. Osbourne, who publicly shared his diagnosis with Parkinson's disease in 2020, has been credited with helping invent heavy metal with Black Sabbath, and went on to have a successful solo career in the 1980s. He later went on to star in his hit MTV reality show, The Osbournes, which first aired in 2002 and focused on his life with his wife, Sharon, and two of their children, Kelly and Jack. Black Sabbath, dubbed the Beatles of heavy metal by Dave Navarro of the band Jane's Addiction in 2010, released their self-titled debut album in 1970. The band fired Osbourne in 1979, citing instances of him turning up to rehearsals late and missing performances. But Osbourne continued performing as a solo artist, releasing 13 of his own albums. He earned the nickname Prince of Darkness. Osbourne built a reputation for outlandish behavior. In one memorable instance, he bit the head off a bat that a fan tossed onto the stage while he was performing in 1981. He reunited with Black Sabbath in 2013 when the band released its final studio album, 13. Osbourne was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with Black Sabbath in 2006 and as a solo artist in 2024. July 30, tens of thousands of fans lined the streets in his hometown of Birmingham, UK, to pay their respects as his funeral cortege made its way through the city center. Black Sabbath had reunited on stage in the city just weeks before Osborne's death for a farewell show, July 5. Bands including Metallica, Guns N' Roses, Slayer, and Pantera performed, as well as supergroups that included musical heavyweights such as Aerosmith's Steven Tyler, Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello, Red Hot Chili Peppers' drummer Chad Smith, and singer Youngblood, who wrote in a tribute for Time that Osborne taught the world that it is beautiful to live outside of the box. Tributes poured in following the news of Osborne's death, reflecting the range of musical talent and lives he influenced. Among them, singer Rod Stewart, Ronnie Wood of Rolling Stones, Gene Simmons of the band Kiss, rapper and actor Ice-T, Public Enemy member Flavor Flav, and Elton John, who wrote in an Instagram post, "He was a dear friend and a huge trailblazer who secured his place in the pantheon of rock gods, a true legend." Former Van Halen singer Sammy Hagar, who performed at the farewell show, wrote in a social media post, "Ozzy Osbourne was and will always be a one-of-a-kind true rock legend. For him to have been that close to death July 5 and still get up and perform like he promised, wow, that puts him in a category of his own. Talk about commitment and loyalty to your fans. Nobody's going to outdo that ever. R.I.P., my brother, you did it all." And more short sketches here on the bottom margin of the page. Died, three more. Singer Connie Francis, July 16 at 87. Jazz musician Chuck Mangione, July 22 at 84. Satirical songwriter Tom Lehrer, July 26 at 97. Canceled, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert by CBS. Colbert had previously criticized CBS parent company Paramount's $16 million settlement with President Trump. Killed, four people after a gunman opened fire in a Manhattan office building home to entities like the NFL and Blackstone, July 28. The shooter took his own life. Sued, right-wing podcaster Candace Owens by Francis' first couple for defamation, July 23. Owens has falsely claimed the French First Lady was born male. Identified, two cancer drugs that might also slow or reverse symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. UCSF researchers found the drugs restored memory in mice. The brief news, health. A Walmart heir has opened a medical school by Alice Park. This is a lengthy article. I may abbreviate this. July 14, 48 students walked through the doors of the Alice L. Walton School of Medicine in Bentonville, Arkansas, to become its inaugural class. Some came from neighboring cities, others from urban centers in Michigan and New York. Almost all had a choice in where they could become doctors, but took a chance on the new school because of its unique approach to rethinking medical education. Named after its founder, the world's richest woman, and an heir to the Walmart fortune, the school will train students over the next 4 years in a radically different way from the method most traditional medical schools use. Instead of drilling young physicians to chase symptom after symptom and perform test after test, Walton wants her school's graduates to keep patients healthy by practicing something most doctors today do not prioritize, preventive medicine and whole health principles, which involve caring for, not just treating, the entire person and all the factors, from mental health to living conditions and lifestyle choices that contribute to well-being. Those are not new ideas, of course, but traditional medicine has only paid lip service to them. Experts have noted that while as much as 80% of medical education focuses on biology, about 60% of premature deaths are due to behavioral factors, including lifestyle habits like diet, exercise, and smoking. I applied to 34 schools, and nowhere else are they doing this, says Ellie Andrew Vaughn, who arrived in Bentonville from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Visually, the school lives up to its acronym, AWSOM, Awesome. The building, with its soaring glass walls, is located on Walton family property and includes not just a wellness studio and gym, but also a rooftop park, healing gardens where students can study, growing gardens for producing healthy foods, and a reflection pond. A path from the rooftop park leads through the Ozark Forest directly to the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, which Walton built in 2011, as a reminder to students about the link between healing, art, science, and humanity. Walton is covering tuition for the first five graduating classes. For her investment, Walton anticipates some of the newly minted doctors will bring what they learn to the local community, specifically to underserved areas in Arkansas, Walton's home state. But her grander vision is for the model to spread to other medical schools across the country in regions with few health resources. Creating a new medical school in 2025 is not an easy or obvious project, especially when the mission is to redesign medical education. My brother Jim said, "Oh, that's a big undertaking, Alice." I think my big brother was trying to protect me from myself, she says with a smile. But Walton's first-hand experience as a patient set her on this path. After a serious car accident in the 1980s, she battled a bone infection, multiple surgeries, and lingering health issues for more than a decade. Walton grew convinced our health care system is broken and that someone needed to catalyze change. The doctor-patient conversations that should be at the heart of effective medical care are rare today, and patients are saddled with exorbitant fees that haven't always contributed to better health outcomes. The system also contributes to care deserts in rural America. But where do you start if you want to recreate healthcare from scratch? There is not just one solution, and any strategy needs to account not just for how doctors are trained and practice medicine, but also the financial incentives that currently drive those practices. In 2019, Walton founded the Heartland Whole Health Institute, located steps from the new medical school, which focuses on research, health advocacy, and education about the policies and financial systems necessary to advance preventive care. With Awesome, she is turning her attention to finding a better way to train the people who will populate that system, future doctors. They will get all the science and disease knowledge they need to manage the sick care side of things, Walton says. But I wanted to create a school that really gives doctors the ability to focus on how to keep their patients healthy. To helm the school, Walton chose Dr. Sharmila Makija, a gynecologic cancer surgeon from Alabama, who shared Walton's commitment to whole health principles and improving the quality of health care in the South. The foundation of the curriculum is traditional medicine, but enhanced with the humanities and the arts to improve the delivery of care, says Makija. Both Walton and Makija know their graduates will face challenges in bringing what they learn in the classroom to the real world. We can have whatever curriculum we want, but if they're thrown out in an environment where they're not practicing whole health, then it's for naught, says Walton. The new graduates must be part of the solution to change that, she believes. So Awesome partnered with the local health system, Mercy, which will not only provide clinical exposure to the doctors in training, but also implement some of the whole patient approaches the school is hoping to introduce, including initially with a cardiac care center. There are signs this approach has appeal beyond the heartland. Already, Makija says a few health systems have contacted her about Awesome's whole health focus, and Walton hopes the school will serve as a model of a new type of medical education. If successful, Awesome could prove medical school should and can be about more than just biology and anatomy. It can also be about what drives a person and what feeds them, literally, figuratively, spiritually. Walton is delighted to watch the future of healthcare take root in the places where she played as a child, especially since the area desperately needs better health solutions. It's going to be really exciting and fun to see what happens, she says. And that article was slightly abbreviated. Turning the page to the brief health. Five surprising symptoms of Lyme disease. That's L-Y-M-E by Angela Haupt. Five now we have. Nearly 500,000 people are diagnosed with Lyme disease each year in the U.S. For about 75% of them, the first sign will be a skin lesion that appears 1 to 4 weeks after being bitten by an infected deer tick. But it might not look how you'd imagine. Only 20% of these lesions take on the classic bullseye appearance commonly associated with Lyme. Other early symptoms of Lyme disease mimic what you might experience with flu. A fever, chills, muscle aches, swollen lymph nodes. Within the first 5 to 10 days of Lyme disease infection, most people will experience only these relatively ordinary symptoms. If they are promptly diagnosed with and treated for Lyme, which generally means 2 to 3 weeks of the antibiotic doxycycline, the story often ends there. But for up to 10% of people, most of whom are not diagnosed or treated promptly, the disease triggers lingering serious symptoms. Researchers are not sure exactly what causes chronic Lyme disease, but speculate it could be the result of factors like persistent bacteria or genetic predispositions. When someone has it, there's almost nothing it can't do, says Dr. Amy Edwards, an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, who specializes in infectious diseases. The complex symptoms often stump doctors, but once it's caught you off guard a few times, you're kind of looking for it everywhere. Every time someone comes in with weird symptoms in the summer, you're like, could it be Lyme disease? Here's a look at some of the surprising symptoms Lyme disease can cause, especially as it progresses. These are the five surprising symptoms. Brain fog. Debilitating brain fog is likely caused by Lyme-induced inflammation in the central nervous system. We see a huge amount of brain effects, difficulty focusing, difficulty thinking, difficulty reading, and absorbing information, says Dr. Sunya K. Schweig, who's on the scientific advisory board of the nonprofit Bay Area Lyme Foundation. It can be extremely disruptive to people's lives. Lyme disease can also cause persistent fatigue, even when it's diagnosed and treated early. In one study, people with a history of Lyme were 8 to 15 times as likely to report moderate or severe fatigue as those who had never had the disease. Eye problems. In the early stages of Lyme disease, people sometimes experience eye irritation and conjunctivitis. As the condition progresses, you can get cranial nerve inflammation or infections, and this can cause double vision, called diplopia, Schweig says. Research suggests Lyme can cause sudden vision loss, damage to the optic nerve, and decreased corneal sensation. It's also possible to experience blurry vision, eye floaters, tearing, extreme sensitivity to light, and inflammation of the retina. Bell's palsy. There are 12 nerves called the cranial nerves that originate in the brain and play an important role in sensing and moving different parts of the head, face, neck, and torso. Lyme disease can affect those nerves, triggering Bell's palsy, which causes sudden weakness or paralysis on one side of the face. It's especially common in adults and typically appears several weeks to months after infection. Heart problems. In 1 out of every 100 patients, Lyme bacteria enter the heart tissues, which is called Lyme carditis. This kind of heart inflammation can lead to lightheadedness, fainting, shortness of breath, heart palpitations, or chest pain. In some cases, people develop atrioventricular block, which prevents electrical signals from moving from the upper to the lower chambers of the heart. Some patients require a temporary pacemaker and IV antibiotics, says Schweig. Arthritis. It is the most common way Lyme presents itself in children, says Edwards. Every fall, kids show up in the emergency room in the late fall with a big swollen knee and often a low-grade fever. Sometimes they also have a limp or are unable to put weight on their leg. Many of these children are experiencing arthritis caused by a tick bite they might not have even been aware of during the summer. Kids typically get better once they start a 4-week regimen of doxycycline. The problem, Edwards says, is that not all clinicians make the connection, which can delay diagnosis and proper treatment. Time off reviews, movies. Spike Lee serves another great New York film by Stephanie Zakarik. No other filmmaker loves the dirty old town that is New York more than Spike Lee. Some of us who live there will return from a day out and about, traversing streets strewn with trash or riding in subway cars that smell like an animal stall, and still think this and nowhere else is home. Spike Lee's highest two lowest, and two is the numeral two, in theaters August 22 and on Apple TV Plus September 5 is a new entry on the scroll of great New York films. It is smart, hugely entertaining, and profound. In a way that is anything but sentimental, with Akira Kurosawa as his guiding star, the film is a reimagining of the Japanese master's 1963 High and Low. A police procedural with a deep moral underpinning, Lee's film feels modest and grand at once, a movie you can see on a Saturday night and still be thinking about the next day. Denzel Washington plays David King, a record company mogul who was once riding high, but whose company is now barely breaking even. That company, Stack and Hits Records, is up for sale, but King does not want to give it up. He's scrambling to buy back his controlling stake. His wife Pam, Ilfinish Hadara, is not so sure, but she supports her husband. Their plans shift drastically when King receives a phone call informing him the couple's teenage son, Trey, Aubrey Joseph, has been kidnapped. Within minutes, a phalanx of cops shows up at their swanky apartment. Tension hangs in the air like the Luke's Mod chandelier suspended from the penthouse's impossibly high ceilings. And then Pam and David learn Trey has been found. The kidnapper snatched the wrong kid, grabbing his best friend, Kyle Elijah Wright, the son of King's chauffeur, and closest friend, Paul Jeffrey Wright, father of Elijah in real life. Highest to Lowest has been adapted rather faithfully from Kurosawa's version, which was based on a novel by Evan Hunter. That means the initial moral quandary, should King feel obligated to pay a $17.5 million ransom, money he does not really have, to save a kid who's not his own, is resolved rather quickly. But King's hesitation to save his best friend's child tells us something about him. As a guy who's built a fortune signing artists, King has the best ears in the business. But even he balks at saving his friend's kid. He's the kind of guy who will do the right thing eventually. That is not a damnation of him. It is just a reminder that it's human nature to put oneself first. We all stumble on the path to generosity. And Washington is terrific at capturing the texture of all those doubts. He can turn a modest squint into a signal of intense moral reckoning. And he has more than one terrific scene with one of his co-stars, the roguishly charismatic A$AP Rocky. They play off one another with the crackling competitiveness and camaraderie of ace jazz musicians trading eights. The rest of High to Lowest fulfills every expectation of a modern Spike Lee movie, though he gave us one of the greatest New York movies in 2001 with 25th Hour. He has not made a movie set there since 2012's Red Hook Summer. This one, shot by Matthew Libatique, is gleamingly beautiful from the opening sequence, depicting the city in all its pigeon-feather splendor as, oh, what a beautiful morning, soars. As tunes go, this one, with its homespun reference to corn growing high as an elephant's eye, is the opposite of urbane, but the incongruity is the point. Every choice pays off. And the movie's action centerpiece involving a subway chase, a Puerto Rican day celebration, and a motorcycle relay might be the most beautifully edited sequence this year. We knew from the beginning Lee was a rule breaker and a groundbreaker, but he's also a traditionalist, an inventive and energetic one. He honors those who came before him, taking their lessons to heart. That is how you get a lustrous entertainment with a soul, like Highest to Lowest. Sometimes great craftsmanship just makes you want to shout. Lee has made films that are just okay, but he always raises the bar. As other standards sink, his climb higher, higher even than an elephant's eye. The top of the Empire State Building is next. Here are a couple of excerpts from Time Off Review's 100 Best Podcasts by Eliana Doctorman. Business and Tech Search Engine, in weekly episodes of this spiritual successor to the wildly popular Reply All, which made host PJ Vogt podcast famous, Vogt tries to answer questions that range from silly to serious, from who buys luggage at the airport luggage store to why are drug dealers putting fentanyl in everything. Mysteries take listeners down twisting paths as he finds experts to aid him in his quest to solve them, and questions beget more questions. It is rare that a new podcast scratches that deep narrative itch that was a hallmark of the form in the 2010s. This one absolutely does. News and Politics, The Prince. Named for Machiavelli's famed Manual for Leadership, in which he declared it was better to be feared than loved, this eight-part series traces the ascent of Chinese President Xi Jinping. Through deep reporting, archival audio, and interviews, the series outlines the rise to power of the notoriously secretive politician, tracking down Xi's American hosts from a 1985 visit to Iowa and a persecuted Uyghur language teacher living in Norway. It serves at once as a portrait of an elusive man and a cultural political history of the country. More podcast titles include Good Hang, Moon Face, Everything is Alive, Dead Eyes, and here's Ologies with Ailey Ward. Ailey Ward interviews experts on different ologies: toothology, squids, biogerontology, aging, even corvid, thanatology, crow funerals, seriously. Ward brings a rollicking abandon and earnest curiosity to conversations that could otherwise trend a little too educational. Just as interesting are the experts who have devoted their lives to niche subjects, like the cucurbitologist who studies pumpkins, or the deltaologist who studies postcards. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.